Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is Rick Meistrom. Rick is 71 years old and has had type 1 insulin-dependent diabetes for over 50 years. This is a disease that's notorious for a host of common complications, including kidney failure, blindness, the loss of limbs due to infection and vascular disease, and early life-threatening heart disease. What's unique about Rick is that he's as healthy as ever. He believes he's healthier because than he would have been if he had never developed diabetes. What we'd like to do today is discuss what he means by that and what he has done to control diabetes and its complications. While we're at it, if you don't have diabetes, I think you're going to learn a lot about how to improve your efforts at dieting and improve your health. Just a short bit more about Mr. Meistrom before we say hi to him. In 1972, he moved here with his family, and he started two businesses. Both were quite successful, and in 1981, at 37, he was named Alaska's Small Business Person of the Year, and actually one of America's top three small businessmen. He then, as well, served two terms on the Anchorage Assembly and two terms as mayor of Anchorage. He was also elected chairman of the Alaska Conference of Mayors and twice selected Alaska's elected official of the year. He also, since I've been up here, I know, was chairman of the America's bid for the 1992 and 94 Olympic Winter Games here in this area. Rick, I've seen you playing golf. I've practiced next to you on the golf range a little bit, but I've never really personally said hi. So thanks for coming, and it's a pleasure to sit here with you.
Thad, I'm happy to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so let's go back these 50-some-odd years, and you're in your 20s and got sick and eventually developed diabetes. So let's start by understanding what that was like.
Well, actually, I had a physical to get into the advanced corps of the Air Force ROTC. I was going to school at the University of Colorado in Boulder. This was 1964, and I had to have a physical before the Air Force would decide to pay for my last 2 years of college. And I had that physical given, and it was on maybe a Wednesday afternoon or something in the summer in Boulder. And I remember about, well, 2 days later, on a Friday afternoon, about 3 o'clock, my roommate came running out to where I was playing tennis with my girlfriend and said, Rick, he said, Dr. DeRue just called and he wants to see you right away. You've got to get down there. He'll keep his office open until you get down there. And he kind of smiled and said, something's wrong, you know, and it was an awkward reaction on his part. But anyway, I got some long pants on and jumped into my 55 Chevy and drove down there. And he asked me if I knew anything about diabetes. And I said, well, I know a kid in high school had it, couldn't eat any candy. That's all I knew. Wow. And he said, well, you've got it. And then he went about sort of explaining a little bit to me. And then he did something really good. He said, I want you to go to Norland Library, which was the University of Colorado Library then, and write down every question, read everything you can about diabetes, and write down every question you can on a yellow pad. And then come back on Monday, and I'll give you a glucose tolerance test, which to confirm this. But he said, I know it's diabetes. And I did that, wrote down all the questions. And while we were going through the glucose tolerance test, he answered all my questions, which was really a good way to do it. And then I left there. They actually gave me a shot of insulin. His nurse did, gave me a shot of insulin and said, I want you to eat something right away. And so I said, okay. And I forgot. I went, started walking along Boulder Creek and cried a little bit and was sort of depressed. I didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And then within a short period of time, I felt something I'd never felt before. And it was the insulin going in and it was my blood sugar going down. And that triggered the fact that I was supposed to eat right away. And I ran across a field to a restaurant and didn't know what to order, but I ordered some roast beef, roast beef and mashed potatoes and gravy, but I had a Coke instead of milk, which was really a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And that Coke kind of saved me, and the potatoes helped raise my blood sugar. But from that point on, after I ate that meal, I felt something I hadn't felt before for quite a long time. I didn't feel hungry again. I mean, for the first time, my cells were actually getting the benefit of what I was eating.
Mm-hmm. So you, to me, you're somewhat unique. You were found before you got into serious trouble, but you were already experiencing some symptoms, but really subtle and not the kind of thing that would draw alarm. And that was that hunger that you had, because you really, well, we'll talk about it in a minute, mm-hmm. but you were not able to take advantage of fully of the food you were eating.
That's true. I had a reputation for just eating a lot of meals, a big meal, and then being able to eat another one very shortly after that. I mean, I'd go and we'd eat breakfast on a Saturday morning with pancakes and syrup and eggs and bacon, and I'd be hungry. I'd be starving in about 2 or 3 hours because that never got to my cells, you know, never got them. And then I urinated a lot. There was frequency of urination because the kidney was just trying to pull all that sugar out of my bloodstream to get rid of it. And so I'd go to the bathroom a lot, and it was a little different than most of my friends, but I didn't think anything of it.
Had there been a family history of diabetes, or now we know, or we think of type 1 diabetes as an autoimmune disorder, so thyroid problems, some arthritis, some other illnesses are in that same ilk. Had that been a family history issue, or you were unique in that sense?
I'm unique. It hasn't been at all. There's none that we can identify with any members of my family.
Let me remind listeners, which I failed to do at the beginning, while you're listening to today's program, if you have questions or comments, there's a couple ways you can get in touch with us. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's define for our listeners who may not be as educated as you obviously are now, I have read at least the most recent book. I think I remember reading some of the first book at one point, but I couldn't put my fingers on it today. What happens with type 1 diabetes? And listeners need to pay close attention, because we're going to also spend a lot of time on type 2, which is also called diabetes, but has a different whole way of occurring and different set of issues about how to treat.
Well, I think the best way to distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes is to talk about what happens when we eat, what happens when a non-diabetic eats, what happens when a type 1 diabetic eats and a type 2 diabetic. Now, and this is a real key thing for all the listeners. When a non-diabetic like yourself, doctor, eats, let's say you eat a hamburger, everything in that hamburger turns into some amount of glucose in your bloodstream. The bun turns into glucose, the lettuce turns into some amount of glucose, the tomato does on there turns into some amount of glucose, the meat itself does. And your pancreas gets a message that says there's glucose in the bloodstream. Pancreas, you need to produce insulin. Well, magically, your pancreas produces just exactly the right amount of insulin to get that glucose out of your bloodstream into your cells for, number one, for energy, number two, for short-term storage as glycogen around the liver, and number three, for long-term storage around all the places you don't want it, you know, your butt and your stomach and your arms and every place, and that's fat. Okay, so that's what happens with non-diabetic. Now, when I eat that same hamburger that you ate, my pancreas gets a message that says there's glucose in the bloodstream. Pancreas, you need to produce some insulin, which is a real key, insulin, to get that glucose into the cells. My pancreas says, hey, sorry, I quit doing that 51 years ago. You want insulin, you put it in yourself. And so that's where I have a pump, and I have to judge every single time I eat something how much insulin I need. And that's how I've learned so much about what every food does. Now, let's talk about a type 2 diabetic. And there's about 10 times more type 2 diabetics out there listening than there is type 1 diabetics. When a type 2 diabetic eats that same hamburger that we ate, it turns into some amount of glucose. The pancreas for a type 2 diabetic gets a message that says, you need to produce some insulin now because there's glucose in the bloodstream. The pancreas basically says, well, I'll try, but I may not be able to produce enough because you've been asking me to produce too much for too long. You haven't been eating right, you haven't been exercising, and I'll do what I can. And so what happens with a type 2 diabetic is the pancreas can't produce enough to get all the glucose out of the bloodstream to get it back down to the normal level. And so it stays at a higher level. And that's what causes all the really serious problems with type 2 diabetics. It causes kidney problems. It causes circulatory problems. It causes eye problems, liver problems, a lot of things that it causes, heart problems. So that's why it's so important that even a type 2 diabetic who says, well, my blood sugar is high, but I feel okay, you've got to understand that there's some problems going on within your body that can be really, really, really serious.
And so the treatment options are different. The type 1 diabetic is not making any insulin. He needs that, or basically he's going to die. I mean, you've got to do something to be able to get that food you use into your bloodstream. Otherwise, your blood sugar goes way, 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 way too high, and there's some serious complications. The type 2 diabetic has some options, however. You want to tell us about that?
I sure will. And let me start with a parable that I use in one of my books. I say, let's say a type 1 diabetic and a type 2 diabetic are stranded on a desert island. And on this island, there's catchable fish, there's edible plants, there may be berries, and there's a way to make fire and drinkable water. Well, without insulin, but neither of these two diabetics have insulin with them. They're trapped in this island, they have no insulin. Without insulin, the type 1 diabetic would be dead in a month. Without insulin, the type 2 diabetic would be cured in a month. And so the interesting thing is that type 2 diabetes is very, very reversible. It's your pancreas has been overworked, and there's story after story after story of people who have read my book and said, my blood sugars were really high, and I'll explain what A1Cs are, but the average of my blood sugars over 90 days were really high, and now it's come way down. And so that's the key for type 2 diabetics. You've got to do it. Because quite frankly, type 1 diabetes has always been considered the more serious. But I put together arguments in my book that say type 2 diabetes is more serious because you get it at an older age and you don't have a lot of time to figure out how to deal with this. You know, when I got type 1 diabetes, I was 20 years old and athletic and healthy, and my body was only 21 years old or 20 years old. And so I had some time to get this figured out. But type 2 diabetics don't have that cushion of time.
Back to symptoms just a minute. I'm thinking about listeners, and they maybe really took to heart your story about the diabetics on the islands. What are the symptoms that would be different? Let's do that for just a second. Between the two on the island, the diabetic who doesn't have insulin and is subsequently going to die because he has no insulin, in the type 2 diabetic, what do they start noticing is happening if they are untreated?
Okay, let me just start with type 1 diabetes, because there's one single symptom that everybody needs to know, parents need to know, and then I'll talk about type 2 diabetes. But for type 1 diabetes, the most parents realize that their kids have a problem when there's excessive urination. Mm-hmm. They're going to the bathroom and they're peeing every half an hour, right. And that's not common. Right. And it's the kidney trying to get all the sugar out of their bloodstream. So that's the most common discovery point for parents with their kids.
And I'm going to say, as a pediatrician, I want to say I have lots of kids, mothers bring kids in, and the point is it's not just in the middle of the night. It's all day long. It's not getting better. It's progressive. Kids who drink a lot of liquids and pee a lot at night. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay, so that's type 1. And right. But now type 2 is more subtle. And I have a chapter in my book saying, gosh, I've got type 2 diabetes and my blood sugar's high, but I feel fine. What's the problem? Well, it's a lot more subtle to pick out the problems with type 2 diabetes. And oftentimes it just comes from getting a physical. But there is, sometimes you can be, there's a little bit of weakness from it. There's not a noticeable excessive urination unless your blood sugars are really, really high. But it's quite a bit more subtle, and it's hard to identify something that you can say, this is it, unless you have it for a long time, and then you start not being able to feel very well in your feet, you have a neuropathy, your vision gets a little bit blurry. But that's only happens when a person's had diabetes a couple of years and they don't know it. So those are really serious symptoms.
Once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Rick Maestrom. Rick is 71 and has had insulin-dependent diabetes for over 50 years, and what's truly unique is no complications. So we're learning a little bit about diabetes right now, and we're going to get a little bit more into some of the things that that Rick has amazingly learned himself about foods and controlling diabetes. If you've got questions or comments in Anchorage, our number 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. Let me take you back just a second again, if you don't mind, to that diagnosis. So did you go to the library and read about diabetes and get some questions?
I did. There wasn't, I'll tell you, there was a lot less known about diabetes than there is now. And but one of the things the doctor said to me that was a little bit scary in retrospect, but somehow it didn't bother me. He said, you know, Rick, he said, you're 20 years old, and by the time you're 40 years old, you could have some health problems. You may have to use a cane to walk. You may have some eye problems. It's really serious. And I remember thinking, gosh, that's 20 years from now. That's a whole lifetime, you know. And when you're 40 years old, you must walk with a cane anyway, you know. So, but I did learn a lot about diabetes. I asked a lot of questions, but there wasn't much information about food, you know. And I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll eat a lot of puffed rice cereal, because that seemed like the lightest thing I could eat. And then, you know, I was supposed to eat stuff that didn't bring your blood sugar up. And so I put down a lot of puffed rice cereal. But those early years, Chad, I couldn't measure my blood sugar. In order to measure my blood sugar, which I can do now in 10 seconds, in order to measure my blood sugar then, I had to call a doctor, set an appointment. The doctor would talk to me. She would fill out a lab request. I'd go downstairs to the lab. The lab would take blood out of my arm. They would send it to an analytical lab. 3 days later, it would come back to the lab here in Providence. And 4 days later, my doctor would call me and say, well, your blood sugar was 215 four days ago.
Right.
And that doesn't help you at all. Yeah. Now I do it 10 times a day.
So one of the real advances that has enabled you to really understand better about what's happening with your body and how you are treating it, let me put that in quotes, is this advance in being able to quickly, daily, get accurate monitoring of, at any time, what your blood sugar is.
That is absolutely the best thing that's ever happened for diabetics. I mean, I think that's more important than the insulin pump.
Yeah.
And I would really encourage people to, whether you have type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes, to measure as often and as frequently as you can. I know sometimes if you don't have insurance, it's expensive, but boy, that's the best thing that's happened in diabetic care.
You know, something just dawned on me, and I was talking to you before the program, but unfortunately, I don't manage diabetes anymore. Now everybody goes to a specialist. But one of the things I do know is that we're struggling with behavior change, and I'm also an athlete, and athletes want feedback very, very quickly to adjust what they're doing, and it's got to be accurate feedback. And so being able to get that blood sugar real quickly is a behavioral change mecca for you, and it encourages you. If you get it back and it's 250, you know right now, hey, yeah, I am screwing up.
Yep.
And I've never really conceptualized that the importance of that, being able to get that real quickly until just now.
Well, I think we saw it at the start of this program, Chad, before the program started. And that was, I tested my blood sugar and it was 110, and I showed it to you. That was a good number for me, and so I was proud of that. Here it is, right here. This is it. But when it's 250, you know, you've got to do something right away, and I do.
And you understand perhaps at that point what you've done wrong a little bit more quickly.
I understand very, very well what I've done wrong now, right, because I've given myself 60,000 blood tests over the past 34 years since self-testing was available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after almost every meal I've eaten over the past and every snack I've had over the past 34 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's told me so, it's in general, it's given me so much information about what foods do. And then 5 years ago, about 5 years ago, I started really structuring tests every morning. And I'd test my blood sugar every morning. I'd wake up and make sure it was stable. Then once I knew it was stable, then I'd eat a different food every morning. You know, you haven't eaten, you haven't lived until you've had broccoli for breakfast or you've had a cherry pie for breakfast. But I tested all kinds of different foods and didn't give myself a shot for 90 minutes and let my blood sugar go up. And I charted it and then had it graphed. And that's the core of my book, What Should I Eat to Solve Diabetes, Lose Weight, and Live Healthy? And it's helped me so much. I mean, my control is so good, and I've got no complications at all.
We definitely are going to come back to this. This is a truly remarkable story in my mind anyway, but we do have one caller. Let me take Don right now, and let's see what he has to say. Don, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you. Hello, Rick. Good to hear you again.
Thanks, Don.
Yeah, I came up here in 68, and I had a heart attack about 20 years ago, but I really didn't get into the diabetic scene until about 15 years ago. And I had a couple of times where I was more or less isolated in a situation. I kept trying to tell parties, I said, hey, you know, let me have a piece of hard candy or something at night. I said, I got to do something to kind of keep my sugar up just a little. Mm-hmm. And they didn't discover for certain that I had any diabetic problem until they said, well, we want you to come in first thing in the morning and have us check your blood. I said, okay. And I kept going in, and everything was all right. This goes on for several days. And she said, wait a minute, are you eating anything at night? I said, yeah, I always do. Don't.
Now, are you a type 1 or type 2? You must be a type 2 diabetic, aren't you, Don?
I'm told, basically, I'm borderline, that I really don't take any insulin of anything. I just keep a close eye on my diet.
That's
at one point,
that's
they
the
thought
best,
I
that's the best way to handle it.
Something. Yeah, and they had me packed up ready to go to the hospital. And I said, no, don't, you know, save your time and effort. I said, just, you know, give me a little a half a cup of apple juice or something, sure. And that'll bring my blood sugar back up, because what had happened was it sunk down below 30 or something, and I passed out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that happens. Don, you bring up a good point in this that I want to bring out to all the listeners out there. Is I wish that the term, there are some type 2 diabetics who are insulin dependent, and there's some of you out there. Mm-hmm. Now, I wish when they started that term, they would have called it insulin assisted instead of insulin dependent. Because they can get off insulin if they take care of eating correctly. So I refer to type 2 diabetics as insulin assisted when they need it, and type 1 diabetics as insulin dependent.
Yeah.
Okay, Don.
I'm 74 now. I've gotten used to the concept of, number one, making sure you get something on your stomach for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And some of the best things I've found to kind of balance out the sugar concept so you don't get the real big swing on the high and then way down low again. I try to make sure I get a little honey, maybe a little peanut butter and cinnamon or something.
Peanut butter is good for that. Honey, not so good, but peanut butter is really good for that. You want to eat a little more fat before you go to bed. That stabilizes your blood sugar.
Yeah, but, or an egg or whatever, you know, something with some additional protein in it to help keep your system up, and so you don't get worn out. I used to be, or still
Don,
am.
Don, let me recommend something, Don, to you. Okay.
Part of the iron poor.
Don, let me recommend something that I think you'd like. Is go to rickmystrom.com, and there's a video on there that will really give you some good information about foods you can eat to get your blood sugar stabilized, so it doesn't go down too low or up too high. But at rickmystrom.com, there's just put on the, it's free. Just click on the video and you'll learn.
Just listen here. This is, you're going to listen. You're going to learn some important stuff about what you eat that you, I suspect, don't know. All right.
Eating is part of it. Exercise, I'm learning with the operation on the varicose veins, is another part.
Yep. All right. Stay tuned. Thanks for your call, Don. Let's do this. We're right at a good break. I want to come back and really talk about this research that you did, which is, to me, very, very interesting, very useful, very reliable bits of information. But I'm going to have to take our normal break. We're already about close to 30 minutes into this thing. So let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion on diabetes with Rick Maestrin. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage and Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is former Mayor Rick Maystrom, and we're discussing diabetes, both type 1 and really to a large degree type 2, and some insights that Rick has discovered that can help us all who are trying to optimize our health. With questions that you have, email them to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10, you're listening to a rebroadcast. We won't be able to help you. Anytime you want to listen to this program again, however, you can go to the Line One Archives at alaskapublic.org and listen once again to the program. So, Rick, one of the most fascinating things I found in the book that you read, particularly the second book, What Should I Eat, was this personal research. And I run across lots of people, and lots of people tell me about things that they've done is kind of research. But I want you to spend a little bit of time on the detail that you did on this, because this is rather unique. And as you also understand, one person does not make a great bit of breadth of research, because we're all can be different. But there is plenty to for all of us to take away from what you've discovered here.
Well, Fed, thank you very much for that. It kind of happened about 6 or 7 years ago. I was at a reception, and I was talking to a couple of doctors, and I mentioned to them that I thought I was healthier because I had diabetes than I would have been without it. And they both knew me, and they said, Rick, write a book. You know, write a book about that, because America needs to know about this. And I thought about the book for about a year before I got it started. And I came up with the thought of the fact that only a type 1 diabetic can really measure what goes on inside the body, because a type 1 diabetic produces no insulin. So if I eat food and I don't give myself a shot with my pump, then my blood sugar just goes up inside my body, and it tells me exactly what happens. What kind of foods really make it go up fast, and what kind of foods don't make it go up fast, and what kind of foods put more of a strain on my pancreas, and what kind of foods add to my weight, and what doesn't. And so I spent 3 years, about 2.5 years, measuring this. I'd wake up in the morning, make sure my blood sugar was stable. Then I'd eat a different food. And then I would, every 10 minutes, I'd set my iPhone to go off every 10 minutes. And that was really strict on my protocol. I'd walk 7 steps to where the paper was. I'd read the paper. When my iPhone would go off, I'd walk 7 steps back to the counter. I'd test my blood. I'd record it, I'd chart it, and then I did that over and over. And I did that hundreds of times with all kinds of different foods. And I found out that first of all, the way we categorize foods, we say there's proteins, fat, and carbohydrates.
Or sugars, which some people, the carbohydrates are basically sugars.
Carbohydrates are everything. Yeah. Everything, if it's not a protein or fat, it's a carbohydrate.
Right.
And I found that there's 4 different categories of carbohydrates that all react differently in terms of blood sugar and in terms of weight. And so after testing this over and over for 3 years, I realized that sweet carbohydrates, of course, are the really bad people, the really bad foods. And we knew that. They make blood sugar go up really high. They put a lot of strain on your pancreas, and they make it hard to control blood sugar. But I also found sweets are sort of the enemy we know. But I also found that starchy carbs, and that's muffins, bread, spaghetti, pasta, potatoes and corn, which are vegetables but act more like starchy carbs. Those things really make your blood sugars go up high too. And cereals. Cereals are killers. Dry cereals are just terrible for blood sugar. And so I have a category called starchy carbohydrates, and they make your blood sugar go up high. And in the book, What Should I Eat?, it shows graphs of what each of these foods do. Now, those are the bad ones. Sweets and starches are the bad ones. You get into your friends, and here's your friends. Vegetable carbohydrates are great. With the exception of corn and potatoes, vegetable carbohydrates are wonderful. You can eat all the vegetables you want. And you're not going to raise your blood sugar. And you can put all the butter you want on vegetables, and you're not going to raise your blood sugar. And I'll talk about that in just a second. So here's your friends. Vegetable carbs, fruit carbs to a certain degree. You can't eat all the fruit you want. You can't eat it unlimited. You've got to control it a little bit. But fruit carbs to a degree. Protein is a friend of yours in terms of weight and blood sugar. And fat. Fat is your friend. Fat does not cause blood sugar to go up. Fat does not add weight. And in the books, you'll see, I do things like I'll have a vegetable without butter, and then I'll have the same vegetable graft with butter. And the result is generally less than 1% increase because of the butter. And it goes in more slowly. And the slower this energy from the butter goes in, or from the food you eat goes in, the bigger the chance you have to burn it before it gets stored. So it's a little complicated to talk over the air, but anyway, the friends in general, what I found, and it's just fascinating, I realized years ago that butter didn't make my blood sugars go up and didn't add anything to my weight. But I can measure, at the end of every day, my insulin pump tells me how much insulin I've used. And if I use between 25 and 30 units a day, I lose weight. If I'm giving myself on average between 30 and 35 units a day, I'm stable. And if I'm averaging more than 35 units a day, I gain weight. So insulin, the amount of insulin you use, is exactly what determines how much weight you gain. But you can't tell your body not to produce insulin. But what you can do is eat things that don't raise your blood sugar so much. Mm-hmm. Because that's the key to weight gain, and therefore the converse of that is the key to weight loss. And I have that in my book, and in the book What Should I Eat explains all of this in a very detailed manner and shows the graphs of what every food does to your blood sugar and weight. I shouldn't say every food. I say all the foods I've tested, what they do to your blood sugar and weights.
To me, it's a rather incredible insight that it dawned on you that you are a perfect – it had the perfect opportunity to explore what foods do to sugars because you made no insulin. And I'm not sure I've ever heard that. Maybe others that are more specialized in this area, but that insight by itself was incredible. And then you took it a step further, realizing you had to be very precise about how you did this and control as many other variables as you could, how much exercise you're doing, what time of day, all of that stuff, and came out with this huge amount of information about what really does drive glucose and in turn insulin needs, and in turn determines a little bit about whether we're going to gain weight or not.
It does. And one of the things that is really significant is that only, as you mentioned, only a type 1 diabetic can do this. And I don't think it has ever been done before. Researchers, I presume, are very hesitant to ask a type 1 diabetic or a group of type 1 diabetics in a test to eat food and not give themselves a shot, because it's not good for them. And I think they're sort of setting themselves up for all kinds of legal problems, et cetera. So it hasn't been done before, ever. And that's where I think this is so, it was sort of a revelation when I came up with that. I said, you know, I'm the only person, only a type 1 diabetic can do it. Now, other type 1 diabetics could do it too, but it takes a really motivated person to do it. It takes a person that's had it for a long time and understands it, and a person that has a sense of a scientific orientation that can sort of do these tests. But it's so helpful.
We had an email that asked whether or not you use a continuous glucose monitor. If not, why not?
I don't. I've tried it a couple times when they first came out, and they were pretty inaccurate then. And now I test my blood sugar about anywhere between 6 and 15 times a day. And it's just like washing my face, you know. It's very, very simple. And so I'm just in the habit now, and I've been able to control things really well. I'm able to control my, I don't have any nighttime problems at all in terms of my blood sugar, because I've got my basal rate in my pump that balances everything. So there's really no need for me to change to a continuous monitor.
How does this information that you now have codified in your book help a type 2 diabetic?
Well, it will help. It's so important for type 2 diabetics, because let me sort of illustrate, and I'm going to use a car metaphor. If you have a car engine and you're always running it on the red line on the tachometer, which that means you're over revving the engine, that engine isn't going to last very long. And what these graphs tell a type 2 diabetic is how hard a different food will make their pancreas work. And the more foods you eat that create really high glucose, the harder your pancreas is going to have to work, and the less length of time it's going to last. It just isn't going to last that long. It also, when you look at the graphs, the speed that it goes in shows on all the graphs, the peak, which is how hard your pancreas has to work, and the gray area beneath the graphs are sort of the contribution to weight. So those are all really important things that a type 2 diabetic needs. And it can save the lives of type 2 diabetics and really help any person who wants to lose weight understand how to gain and how to lose weight.
And that was my next question. How can we all benefit from it? And so basically you've discovered a way to eat without really pressing up that glucose. And if we don't press up the glucose too high, we don't end up storing extra glucose in the form of fat and gaining weight.
That's exactly right. And it's, you know, fat, when you think about this, people think, and the government's been telling us for 30 years, you get fat because you eat too much fat. Period. Wrong. Yeah,
right.
Dead wrong.
Right.
It isn't.
Right.
And it's, you know, you think about a cattle feedlot and think about eating a ribeye steak with all that nicely marbled fat in there. Mm-hmm. That cow didn't eat 1 ounce of fat. They ate grain, which is what I call starchy carbs for cows. Mm-hmm. And their goal was to make those cows as fat as they can, as fast as they can. They didn't feed them fat. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying to myself, how can I convince people that fat is not the problem? It doesn't cause cholesterol problems. It raises your HDL, the good stuff, much more the more fat you eat. My LDL is about average, the bad stuff. My HDL is so high because I eat lots of butter. Mm-hmm. But it Time Magazine came out helping me out about a year ago, and they came out with a cover story that said, eat butter. And then below it was the subhead, scientists have labeled fat the enemy, why they were wrong. Mm-hmm. And there's 8 pages on why fat is not the enemy. And the American Heart Association has taken restrictions, dietary, all the restrictions off eating dietary fat. And there was an article in Runner's World Magazine, January 2015, 6 months ago. And it said, eat fat, be fit. And it started out by saying, the Annals of American Medicine analyzed 76 studies trying to find an association between dietary fat and cholesterol problems, and they found no association. So that's a change, and that's a big change, but I talk about that in the book a lot.
So we are progressing in our understanding of what's driving obesity, and I think you would agree with something I've been saying for a long time on the program, is we're not as active as we used to be, and we eat too much. What you're bringing focus onto is what it is that we're eating that is too much, and we've been under the wrong assumption that it had to do with fats and maybe proteins and steaks and eggs and so forth. But it turns out it's certain kinds of carbohydrates that is now where the evidence is pushing. And I'm going to go ahead and bring up the term glycemic index, because the other fascinating thing to me is what you're describing here is what is known now as high and low glycemic index foods.
It is. I was doing that long before the glycemic index became the glycemic index.
I know.
And I realized this, but yeah. I didn't come up with that term. That wasn't mine. But there's a lot to be said for that, the glycemic index. And the foods that I have that show blood sugar going up high are the ones that the glycemic index shows as high glycemic foods. Mm-hmm. So it's real important for folks to understand that. And it's not just calories. Calories are only, they're only valid if you're eating the same type of food. But you'll see in my book that you can eat a Hershey bar that's 210 calories. And that will make your blood sugar go up really quite high, up to, I think, mine's 260. I think it brought it up to 260. Whereas you can eat a piece of salmon, a big piece of salmon, with 420 calories, twice as many calories as the Hershey bar, and it just barely makes my blood sugar go up. And so there's almost no weight gain with salmon at all, with halibut, with shrimp, with cod. Those are almost free foods. Mm-hmm. There's almost no weight gain. So calories, we've been counting calories in America for 30 years, and we've been getting more and more obese, you know, for the past 30 years. So there's a lot of problems, but I think we have the beginning of some big solutions. Not only, you know, the interesting thing is this was not intended to be a weight loss book, but I get letter after letter of people saying, right, you know, I'm not only am I blood sugar down, but I'm losing weight, right, which is exactly what happens. It was really just designed for diabetics. And if you're a type 1 diabetic, you really should get, or if you're the parent of a type 1 diabetic or grandparent, both books, My Wonderful Life with Diabetes, which is really encouraging and inspiring for young diabetics, and then What Should I Eat to Solve Diabetes, Lose Weight, and Live Healthy. So type 1 diabetics need both books. Type 2 diabetics really just need the What Should I Eat book, and that will really help them. And you can go to rickmystrom.com, and there's a good video that will show you a lot of the things visually, a lot of the things we're talking about today.
It's several short little videos, which I started to put a link to on here, but it's right on your website, and they're excellently done, Rick.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan.
I'm going to just diverge just a second. It's not just about eating, though. You've stayed active, so exercise and staying active are other components of this. You want to at least talk about those things, mm-hmm, and then tell me which of those three, activity, exercise, we might lump into one, and maintaining a good diet is the most important.
Well, one of the things I've tested, and activity and exercise, I kind of lump as one too. But the food, my conclusions are that it's about 80% what you put into your body and about 20% how you burn it. And I'll tell you how I came to that conclusion. During a given day, if I eat really well, eat the right foods, but I don't exercise, I need to give myself about 20% more insulin than I would. So if I eat well, but I don't exercise, I need to give myself more insulin, which means I'm going to gain a little bit of weight. But if I exercise really well, but eat terribly, eat bad foods, eat starchy carbs, pancakes, or spaghetti or something, then I have to give myself about 80% more insulin. So what you put in your body becomes more important than how you burn it. But being active, moving, is so important. And one of the things I've discovered, too, is that if I move for just 15 to 20 minutes between dinner and the time I go to bed, my insulin requirement for that night is down by about 10%, 15%. And so what I suggest to people is don't eat dinner and then sit down in a chair and just watch TV set and go to bed. You know, Try to go shopping, go buy some groceries, move around the yard, take a walk around the yard, go out and work a little bit for 15, 20 minutes. Doesn't have to be a lot, but if you just start moving after dinner, it makes a huge difference in your weight gain that night. So exercise is important. I do some fairly structured exercise. I've been going to the Alaska Club for 30 years now, but I don't work out really hard. You know, it's about a 40-minute workout, and the first 10 minutes are talking to friends. that sort of gets me going. And then I have a light workout for strength training with weights and maybe 20 minutes of aerobics. So The key to working out is never work out so hard that you don't want to go back the next day and do it again. Mm-hmm. And so I don't work out hard, but I show up and I'm there.
So from a medical standpoint, I've always read or been told that what exercise makes insulin more efficient. So it helps you control a type 2 diabetic who's overusing their insulin or resistant to the effects. It helps that.
It does. Let's say that's sort of a different way of saying what I was saying.
Yeah. But intake is what you've discovered, at least I think it is generalizable. Yes, it is only your body that found these numbers, mm-hmm. but everybody that's a type 1 diabetic is going to find the same thing, and those of us who might be type 2 or pre-diabetic, we may see things a little differently. But the same principles are very likely to hold throughout all of us, is it's the kind of carbohydrate that we're eating that is where the real problem is beginning to appear to lie, at least it looks like it in your information, and as I understand glycemic index issues, it all comes together pretty nicely. And so if we want to lose weight and we're not diabetic, we just use the same principles.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And what you said was, I think, very true, the kind of carbohydrate. And I have so many people come up to me and say, oh, my doctor said I should eat less carbs. Well, what does that mean? Eat less broccoli, eat less cauliflower, Brussels mm-hmm. sprouts? So that's what I've done in this book. And I'm going to say this one more time because it's so important for the listeners out there. There are four different kinds of carbs based on what they do to your blood sugar. There's sweet carbs that we know are bad. There is starchy carbs that most people don't know how bad they are. I've had people say, gosh, I keep gaining weight and all I eat is a bagel for breakfast. Well, that's terrible. That's like eating two donuts for breakfast. So there's sweet carbs, bad. Starchy carbs, you've got to really minimize those. You don't want to cut them out altogether because this is something that, you know, it's just part of living. But minimize starchy carbs. Fruit carbs, you have to be a little bit careful of, but eat all the vegetable carbs, all the protein, and all the fat you want. And that's not gonna cause any problems at all. So those are the ones. Be really, of course, be careful with sweet carbs and be very careful and minimize starchy carbs all you can.
So with today's modern glucometers and the email that we got, you can continuously monitor what your glucose is. It gives us a point in time or right now where we are. You mentioned the term hemoglobin A1C earlier. Mm-hmm. Diabetics know, I hope, what that means. For listeners, again, tell us a little bit more about what that number is telling us.
Okay, it's called A1C, and I don't know how they got for that from glycosylated hemoglobin, but they call it A1C, so that's all you have to remember. And what that is it's the measure of the glucose that has attached itself to your hemoglobin, that's your red blood cells. And the red blood cells only have a life of about 90 days, and there's new ones that are generated. So what this test does is it tests how much glucose is attached to the red blood cells, and that tells you what your blood sugar control has been like for 90 days, the past 90 days. And good numbers are good for a non-diabetic. The numbers are high fives and maybe low sixes, maybe high fives, 5.7, 5.8, 5.9. For a really well-controlled diabetic, the numbers are about 6.1, 6.2, 6.3. For a poorly controlled diabetic, those numbers can be 9, 10, 11, 12, and that talks about serious, that tells you what the serious problems are, what's the serious problems are coming. So ask your doctor about A1C. If you get a chance to get the A1C taken, it's just a finger prick. It used to be a little more complicated. But that'll tell you how you're doing. And if the A1C is above 7, that sort of says that you've got type 2 diabetes, and you better start really watching things carefully before it gets out of control.
All right, I want to go back to your story, and I want to go back to understanding your mind a little bit more, because I think it's a little different. You've had diabetes for a number of years, and all of a sudden it dawns on you, well, I can figure out what foods do to glucose, which I've noticing that exercise and certain foods seem to do something because I'm taking my blood sugar all the time. And now I really want to understand that. So what's driving this? Is it I want to understand what's going on, or is it, hey, I want to live as long as I can, and I better get my act together and understand this better because no one else has given me this precise information. Where were you at that particular time?
Well, you know, part of that time is that part of the reason is that I finished my last term as mayor in 2000, 15 years ago now. Wow. And my son took over our apartment business and has been doing a great job running that. And so I had time in my life. And I'm not the kind of guy that can sit around and say, okay, well, I'll play golf and I'll go fishing and that's it. Those are great, nice, nice breaks for me, but that's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And so it was talking with a couple of doctors and talking with some friends of mine on a golf trip to Spokane, talking about food. And they were so interested in what I had to say about food, what I'd learned. And they, by the time we finished that golf trip, they said, Rick, you've got to write a book. And the same thing that the two doctors at a reception said, you know, you've lived healthy at that time for 45 years. You need to tell America what you did. Write a book. And so that triggered writing the book. But then, and I wrote the first one, and I thought about, I had to break it down into two books, really. And the second one, I thought, you know, how can I visually show people what I know? And I came up one day with the idea of graphs in there, that I could graph foods, and I realized that only a type 1 diabetic can graph, you know, graph things like that or graph what happens inside your body. And so that's what got me started in graphing it. And another, my ophthalmologist now, and, you know, ophthalmologists can really tell how you're doing in terms of your circulation system because you have tiny little capillaries in your eyes, and they're the only capillaries that you can see. And he kept saying, Rick, he said, you know, I've never had a diabetic patient of more than 20 years that I can't see problems in their eyes with aneurysms and neovascular growth and little bubbles in the capillaries. He said, you've had it 50 years, and I can't even tell you have diabetes. Your capillaries are just great. And so that triggered me to write this second book. I said, I can share this with America. I need to do it. And I remember giving my first speech on the book to Rotary, and I said, I want to change the way America eats. And I could hear a couple of snickers in the back of the room, you know, oh, yeah, right, right, Rick. But, boy, if you're out there, if you know anybody that has type 2 diabetes, go to my website and get an introduction to it, rickmystrom.com, or get the book, What Should I Eat? Because it'll change their lives and make them healthier. They'll be more active. And it's not just to have a longer life, but it's to have a healthier life longer. And that's a big difference. And, you know, Anchorage is full of stories of very bright people who have died after 10 years after they've got type 2 diabetes because they just didn't get it. And they're smart people. They can do it. So it was a fun project for me to do this. And even though you could argue that it hurt me for doing hundreds of tests and not giving myself insulin for 90 minutes, I would argue that I've learned so much more specifically about different foods that it's improved my control even from what it was before, which was very good.
Well, it gets back to the introduction, which is something I'm taking from your book. You feel you're healthier now than you would have been if you didn't have diabetes because of it. And perhaps one example is that ophthalmology story, because ophthalmologists can get a very good idea of what our vascular looks like. And our vascular is a direct relationship to, that's not true. I mean, it's a very good indicator of how we are handling our foodstuffs, whether we're handling it appropriately or not, like atherosclerosis and heart disease and peripheral vascular disease and so forth, to a large degree. It's a good, easy window to see how things are going.
Yeah, it is. And I've often wondered why there isn't more people doing that, or why people don't go to the ophthalmologist to see how their hearts, or to see how their circulatory system's doing, because that's what they can tell you. They can tell you if it's good or not. But one thing, going back to type 1 diabetes for a second, I didn't talk too much about that because there's about 10 times more type 2 diabetics out there than there are type 1 diabetics. But one of the things that is a danger for type 1 diabetics is balancing that insulin. And if it gets too high, you have the problems we've been talking about. But if it gets too low, there's another very serious problem, and that is it can result in a seizure. And for you parents or anybody who has a type 1 diabetic child, that's really important to understand the symptoms. And I've had 9 seizures in my life as a result of low blood sugar at night. Most of them were before you could have self-testing, but I've had 3 or 4 after self-testing became available. But I haven't had any. I think 1998 was maybe my last seizure, so I haven't had any in 16 or 17 or 18 years, and I've got it figured out. But if your blood sugar gets too low, and what I mean by too low is averages between, say, 75 and 105 milligrams per deciliter, and you don't have to remember the milligrams per deciliter, but just those numbers, 75 to 105 is about normal. If it gets down below 70, you can start feeling a little bit weak, like you're not very strong, especially if you're doing physical work. If it gets below 60, you start getting little flashes of light. You can't put together sentences quite so clearly. If it gets below 50, then you can't read things, then you're getting to the point where it's going to be hard to figure out exactly what to do. And there's times when I knew I needed orange juice or a Coke or a cookie or something to bring my blood sugar up, and I'd open the refrigerator door and just stare in there wondering what I'm doing looking in the refrigerator, even though I knew I needed something to bring my blood sugar up. So confusion is a symptom. So parents need to learn those, and I've got a chapter called Blood Sugar by the Numbers in my books, both books, I think. And parents need to understand that so they can know what their kids are going through as their blood sugar goes down. Seizures are typically not deadly, but they can be serious. I mean, you can hurt yourself if you have a seizure. There's no doubt about it. And I've woken up in the hospital a number of times and always remember there's people in white around you, and the doctors all say the same thing. Looks like he's coming around. That's the first thing you hear. But it's a scary experience. And type 1 diabetics need to be very, very careful about that. And type 2 insulin-dependent or insulin-assisted diabetics could have that same problem, giving themselves too much insulin.
Just about a minute. What's your final thoughts? What do people need to make sure they take away from this program?
I think they should realize that getting diabetes is not necessarily a sentence to a shorter, unhealthier life. I think that you can look at it as an opportunity to be a healthier life, to live longer, to understand food better, and to have a better life. And it really takes a positive attitude to do it. And you can do it. So look at if you're diagnosed by your doctor as having diabetes, look at it as, okay, this is a chance for me to change my habits, to do better, to live healthier, and you'll have a lot more fun in your life for the last 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years of your life. You'll do it. So it's a manageable thing. Type 1 is manageable. Type 2 is reversible.
I'd strongly recommend all of us read What Should I Eat by Rick Mystrom. It's an excellent book. Also go to his website if you want to get some insight before or in addition to reading that book. My thanks to Rick Mystrom for sharing his insights on living with diabetes. If you want to continue the conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the Line 1 archives and listen to the program once again. Next week, Line 1 will return. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. I want to thank Dave Waldron, who's our audio engineer, and Monica Gokey, who is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.